Welcome back to the Universalis podcast. I am Martin Kohinski, the creator of Universalis, and in this episode I'll be looking at the highlights of the week ahead, starting with Sunday the 14th of September. Over the summer I've been thinking that it might be an idea to talk about the virtues in this podcast, as well as about saints and liturgy. Everyone talks about the vices, but of course the virtues are more important because the virtues are the way we live, not die. They are the way we live rightly. Really, they are the way we live at all. One day I hope to go through all this properly and systematically, but today I'd like to touch on a few puzzles about faith, and then give some proper attention to what I think is one of the most forgotten virtues, hope. The puzzle I have with faith is that people call it a theological virtue, as if it were different from natural virtues like temperance or justice. And I can't see what does make it different. To me, faith is a sort of cousin of reason. It's like the left leg where reason is the right leg. You need both in order to get anywhere. Faith is not only to do with theology, with God. We live by it all the time and in every science. It is by faith that we do mathematics. We trust that the answer will be the same every time we do the sum. And even more, we trust that nobody, however clever and sophisticated, will ever be able to turn round one day and prove to us all that 2 and 2 make 3. These beliefs are deep beliefs about mathematics, and without them there would be no point in doing maths at all. Now, they can't be proved by reason, even though the use of our reason is what guided us towards believing them in the first place. And despite that, we do all believe in maths, even without any formal logical justification for our belief. That is surely faith. Here's another example. Chemistry runs on faith too. Suppose that you have a chemical experiment which works every time you try it, except on Wednesdays. Will that lead you to believe that there's a special thing called Wednesdayness which no one has discovered yet? It will not. It will make you look for other reasons. For instance, it may be that on Tuesday nights the cleaners come round and leave bleach lying around, and that disturbs your experiment the next day. It doesn't matter what the reason other than Wednesdayness will turn out to be. What matters is that you know that there will be some other reason. You know that there can be no such thing as Wednesdayness. And that, you know, expresses the accumulated reasoning of the human race over the centuries. And another word for reason you believe in but can't explain is faith. When we come round to theology, there's a weird and pernicious belief around that religious faith somehow equals unreason. This belief became widespread at the Reformation because a key Protestant doctrine is that human nature is hopelessly corrupt in every way. By itself it can do nothing good, from which it follows that human reason is useless as an approach to the truth. And from that it follows that faith is nothing to do with reason, our job with religious truth is not to understand, but to believe. In fact, the sillier a doctrine is, the more believable it should be, because the more faith it requires to believe it. The Church, on the contrary, treats faith in theological matters as an integral part of reason itself. God makes sense. Jesus says, love him with your mind, which he couldn't say if loving God with the mind, trying to understand God, were a hopeless task. That basic idea is the foundation of my book, The Creed in Slow Motion. So much for faith. If you realize that it applies everywhere and not just in religion, and that faith is not another word for unreason, then perhaps I have just said something worthwhile. Now for hope. When we talk about faith, hope, and charity, hope always seems the hurried middle one, the one we rush past to get to charity. The greatest of these is charity, and all that. Partly it is that we think that hope is uncomplicated, that it means believing in God's promises for the future, the resurrection, the life of the world to come, all that sort of thing. If that was really all it did mean, hope would be an easy virtue to practice. In the sense, you don't really need to practice it at all. It's just a comfortable belief to have about the future and the future after death. It all seems far away and safely theoretical. What I've been discovering recently is that hope is more than that, and also that the virtue of hope is much harder than it looks. To some of us, God gives calm, gentle lives. Think of a voyage across a sea that has a little bit of a swell to it, no more than that. We have our little worries and annoyances, but nothing that keeps us awake at night. When we remember to be grateful for this, we are grateful for it because we know it isn't like that for everyone. It's worth adding just a little footnote to that gratitude. Perhaps God is making life simple because we couldn't handle anything tougher. When you create a beautiful flower, you take care not to send hailstorms to beat it down into the mud. There are other kinds of people. They are the rocks, or the oaks, or whatever you want to think of as strong. God shows it by flinging everything at them that he can, storms, hail, wind, earthquakes, the lot. As soon as you have coped with one lot of adversities, he will give you another. If you wake up in the middle of the night, lying on your left side, and everything hurts, body and mind, with worries and aches and everything, you can try turning over if you want, but all you find, lying on your right-hand side, is new pains, new worries to add to the ones you already had. It is no fun being strong. I know it is a compliment from God when he says, "Here, you are strong, catch this," but there are times when one would honestly prefer to be weak and have the calm seas rather than the storm. Let's say that you have lived like that for a long time. You know that starting from bad, the only direction is worse. Every time you think you've got too much to cope with, you are given still more. You know all about the man of sorrows. You know all about man is born to trouble as the sparks fly upwards. Of course, you pray. You pray all day and all night, and one way or another, your prayers are heard. Then, one day, God does something really bewildering, something you hadn't prepared yourself for. God grants some of your prayers. It is a miracle. You can fill in what kind of a miracle for yourself. Perhaps you had a dread disease and a test shows you are clear of it. Perhaps that job you were sure you'd never ever get, a letter comes saying you've got it. Pick whichever picture you can relate to best. The miracle happens, and suddenly you find that you are unable to respond. You know that it is a miracle and an answer to prayer. A miracle, in a sense, is something that is too good to be true, and somewhere deep in your unconscious, a little voice is saying, "What if this really is too good to be true?" You know when you see someone in the aeroplane hunched over his rosary beads all flight, keeping the plane in the air with sheer willpower? Well then, the plane lands and people are getting out, and there he is, still hunched over those beads. Because what if he stopped now and was happy, and something even more terrible happened? You are used to adversity. You are used to adversity being piled on adversity. You are used to it. In some sense, you can cope with it, even if it is something most people would find uncopeable. What you can't cope with is this, that you stand up at last, unwind, stretch out your arms and open them to welcome the light of the dawn after your long, stormy night, and then something new comes and squashes you flat again. Anything would be better than that. It would be better to stay battered, stay suffering, stay as the man of sorrows. Do you remember St. Peter in prison, awaiting trial and execution, and the angel coming to open the gates for him and lead him to freedom? If you were St. Peter at that time and in that place, you would be very, very tempted to ignore the angel and turn your face to the wall. Because what if all the gates opened except the last one? Or if all of them did and you got out, and round the corner were Herod's soldiers waiting to catch you again? You daren't take the risk of feeling happy. Blessed are those without hope you feel, because they can never be disappointed. The summary of all this is, hope is hard. It is not an easy virtue. I had two pieces of good news recently. One I accepted, even though at the beginning I had a superstitious fear of telling anyone about it. The other I am still holding my breath about, trying not to think about it, just in case. What an idiot! There is no instant cure for the lack of hope, or rather for finding hope difficult to do. To lack hope, not to allow hope into one's life, just in case, is a way of not trusting God. I know that. Perhaps I should apologize to God for it. Or perhaps I should reproach him for not creating me to be more able to trust him than I am. Still, if there's no instant cure, a random look at the Liturgy of the Hours provides therapy. I know this podcast is officially dated the 14th, but look at the first psalm in the Office of Readings for Saturday the 13th. In English and Latin it is Psalm 106, in American and Hebrew it is 107. Here is how it begins. O give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his love endures for ever. Let them say this, the Lord's redeemed, whom he redeemed from the hand of the foe. The thing is, and it's a good general rule, if you're having difficulty having the relationship with God that you ought, in this case it's with the virtue of hope, then spend some time with him in his world, in this case the world of the psalm. I don't know what he will do for you, but he will do it. And one final time, if something is a miracle, if it feels too good to be true, that doesn't mean that it isn't true. There are quite a few martyrs this week, but for me the most inspiring one is St. Cyprian on Tuesday the 16th. You may wonder why, since after all it was someone being killed for the crime of being a Christian. What I think I love about it is that it was such an elegant martyrdom. In a way it was a dance, as each side, Cyprian and the Roman authorities, did exactly what they ought to have done, each with full respect for the other side. Anyway, let me tell the story and you can see what you think of it. It is the middle of the 3rd century AD. We are in the Roman province of Africa, whose capital is Carthage. The bishop of Carthage is called Cyprian, and he is significant in church history in many ways that I shan't go into now. The church is at peace, and for almost 40 years there have been no persecutions. In 257, the emperors Valerian and Gallienus issued a letter commanding that all people should perform the Roman religious ceremonies. Cyprian, as a Christian bishop, would not do this. According to the law, the penalty for disobedience was exile. The proconsul, Aspasius Paternus, said this, and Cyprian agreed. Being the two leading men in the city, they must have known each other quite well. Cyprian was accordingly sent away to the city of Curubis, a seaside town some 30 miles from Carthage. The next year, Galerius Maximus succeeded Aspasius Paternus as proconsul, and new orders came from Rome. Maximus ordered Cyprian to be called back from exile and brought before him. On the 13th of September, two of his most senior officials came to Cyprian's country estate, sat him between them in a chariot, and drove him to a place 6 miles outside Carthage, where Maximus was staying in the hope of regaining his health after an illness. Cyprian stayed the night in the house of one of the officials. All the brethren heard the news, and they crowded into the street outside that official's door. On the morning of the 14th, the proconsul Galerius Maximus summoned the bishop Cyprian to appear before him. The second reading in the Office of Readings is taken from the official court transcripts for the 18th day before the calends of October, that is, the 14th of September 258 AD. Rome is a civilized state and it keeps records and it makes copies of those records, and these particular official records have been copied and recopied through the centuries. It must have been a crowded scene that day. There was the proconsul, There was the bishop. There were the proconsul's councillors, because this was a formal court session. There were the secretaries taking dictation. There were all the crowd of Christians who had slept overnight in the street, because the proconsul had ordered them too to be present. But looking at the real reality, and not at what a camera would see, there were only two people there, Galerius Maximus and Thascus Cyprian. It seemed as if they were the only two men left in the universe, and a new formal dance began. Here it is. Galerius Maximus, the proconsul, said to Cyprian the bishop, "You are Thascus Cyprian?" The bishop Cyprian responded, "I am." The proconsul said, "You hold the office of leader of these men of sacrilegious mind?" The bishop replied, "I do." The proconsul said, "The most sacred emperors have commanded you to perform the rites of the Roman religion." The bishop replied, "I will not do it." The proconsul said, "Consider the matter." The bishop replied, "Do what it has been commanded to you to do. The matter is clear enough, and there is nothing that requires consideration." The proconsul conferred briefly with his councillors, and then, reluctantly, as if he had difficulty forcing the words out, uttered the stern words of the official condemnation. Cyprian had to die by the sword. Cyprian ordered the executioner to be given 25 gold pieces, or aurei. This was an enormous sum, more than 3 ounces of gold. He was duly executed and duly buried. Galerius Maximus, the proconsul, died of the illness he had been suffering from a few days later. I don't know if the specialness of these moments of quiet between Cyprian and Paternus, and then between Cyprian and Maximus, have struck you as they did me. Despite all the crowds, on each occasion two men were alone together. They were the only ones who could direct what was happening and decide how it should turn out, and they were on the same side. They were on the side of order and rightness. They agreed that certain things really mattered, the same things. They agreed that laws existed and that laws had to be obeyed. There is a sense, too, in which the proconsuls Paternus and Maximus could not have gone through with their jobs without Cyprian's help. He gave exactly the right responses at his trials. He kept them firm of purpose in doing their duty. He made sure that they would have nothing to reproach themselves with. For Cyprian, it didn't matter much. The outcome was going to be simple. Quite soon he was going to be with God, and after that it was all in God's hands. But Maximus had to live on, and Maximus would have to live with what he had done. So Cyprian gave him what he needed to be able to do that. He gave him what every high-ranking Roman valued most, the certainty of having done his duty precisely as the law had laid it down. So when we find ourselves in real situations of conflict, let's keep the 14th of September 258 AD in our hearts and remember that our enemy, by considering the same things worth fighting over as we do, has made himself our brother. Once you start seeing the theme of the martyr giving a blessing to his persecutor, you find it in all sorts of places. A few weeks ago we had St. Thomas More's final speech to his judges after his unjust condemnation, or rather, if you prefer, his correct condemnation according to English law. More compared his judges to St. Paul at the stoning of Stephen. I don't know the progress of the judges' hearts and souls after that day, but if any of them found himself having to deal with the wrong he had done, and the devil loves to dig out our wrongs and throw them back at us at vulnerable moments, then perhaps the statement, "I am just like Paul," could have turned out to be a shield. The martyrs of the Korean church, who are celebrated on Saturday the 20th, are very different from St. Cyprian. That is because the society they were martyred in was very different. It was a society not of individuals, but of populations. The Korean state paid exactly the same kind of attention to its constituents as I do to mine. There are 30 trillion cells in my body. I am more important than my cells. If my cells threaten my good, as warts or cancers or anything else bad, I poison them I burn them. I do whatever it takes. I do not worry about myself's feelings or their rights. There's no such concept. In that society, there were no people, only cells. In that sense, there was nothing personal about the persecutions the Korean Christians underwent. They were persecuted and martyred in the most horrible ways imaginable, with as much passion as I would show when putting wart cream on a suspicious-looking bump. Some of their names we know, others we don't. All in all, over time, some 10,000 people died. They didn't die for the church as an institution, because there wasn't one. They died for Christ. The Korean church is celebrated as being remarkable in that way, because it was done almost entirely by lay men and lay women. People got hold of some Christian books and read them. One of them got himself baptized when he visited Peking. He came home and baptized others. Generation after generation, there were Christians. With all those tortures and persecutions, they carried on. The Christians were always there, and they bore witness in that collective society to two things. One was, I am a Christian. The other was, I am. That's all for this week. If you'd like to write to us about anything, email universalis@universalis.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Have a good week in every sense, and let's pray for one another.